Hello and welcome to Africa Media Matters, featuring interviews and comment about media issues across the African continent. I'm Alex Jakana. Coming up, we hear from Radio Shabelle in Mogadishu about the perils facing Somali journalists.
For the last 2 years, only Shabelle, 5 journalists were killed. 7 journalists suffered severe injuries. 21 journalists were in prison. We've been taken off the air and shut down more than 4 times. That explains the risks that the Somali journalists are operating.
More on that and other stories coming up after this. Africa Media Matters is brought to you from the IWPR's Center for Crisis Reporting. IWPR, giving voice, driving change. And we begin today's program by looking at the challenges facing the African media in the internet age. The subject was discussed at length at the recent African Media Leaders Forum in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Conference organizer Eric Chinje, the head of the World Bank's Global Media Program, told IWPR's Yigal Shazan how he thinks African media must change to meet the challenge posed by the internet.
The wise media owner would want to start now, if they haven't started already, looking at their business models, looking at how they incorporate the new technologies into their thinking, and looking at how they prepare their staffs for dealing with a significantly changed landscape. I think we see growth in access to these technologies by the day on the continent. So it would be foolhardy to sit back and say, well, you know, it'll take another 10 years for it to come around.
What lessons can be learned from America and Europe?
First of all, that traditional models no longer work. We see them crumbling all around us. I think there's a swing toward new media, towards the internet, or some hybrid thereof. And I think if there are lessons to learn, it's we can no longer sustain traditional media, and we cannot not open up to new media and new platforms.
What kind of models do you envisage being the most successful?
You know, I wish I had that crystal ball and able to predict what models will work in this new century. I think the key words would have to be partnerships, hybrids, and consolidation. In a world where consumers become producers, producers are consumers, there's no dominant source for information, the tendency to have in any one country 600 news titles, I don't think it's a viable option at all.
The participants at the Yaoundé meeting vowed to end their reliance on donor funding. Is embracing new technology key to achieving this?
What's key to achieving this is taking on a whole new approach to the news business. Media entrepreneurs have to, and I think this was one of the great lessons of the African media leaders in Yaoundé, media owners have to take the tough choices. They can no longer depend on handouts. They can no longer depend on donor funding. They're surviving thanks to brown envelope journalism. They have to make the hard choices. They have to think through business plans. They have to work with financial institutions, venture capitalism. That was the great lesson. And then I think about how they can leverage new technologies to reach new audiences. So a deeper understanding of the market, a clear understanding of where the technology is taking us, and good business plans are the way to go.
So to any African media owners who might be listening, what would your advice be?
They have to be concerned about the future. If they're not, then they're working themselves out of business. They have to pull in techno-savvy young people who can help them think through the options. They have to then engage with financial institutions, with venture capitalists, fund managers, and so on, who can provide them the know-how on developing fundable business plans and strategies in this new age. They have to get going.
Are there any examples of best practice?
On the African continent, there's some interesting things being done by the Nation Media Group in Kenya. We can also look at the IPP group in Tanzania, the whole concept of Media 24, also in Kenya. These are initiatives that give an idea of where things may be going in the future on the continent. They're businesses that have tried to stay at the cutting edge of change, and that's how they are able to not only survive, but turn a profit.
That was Eric Chinje, head of the World Bank's Global Media Program, on the challenges facing the African media in the 21st century. And few journalists face more immediate challenges than those who risk their lives on a daily basis reporting for Radio Shabelle in Mogadishu. Several have been killed, and the station is constantly harassed by Islamic militants. Yet Radio Shabelle continues to fly the flag for independent journalism in Somalia. In recognition of its work, the station was recently awarded the Reporters Sans Frontières Press Freedom Prize. The station's Ali Dahir told Africa Media Matters why he and his colleagues persevere despite the dangers.
It is very, very hard, and sometimes can cost life of colleagues or friends, but obviously it's the service that we believe, and we absolutely enjoy doing it. And we also believe we are serving the community by providing the information they require. We believe we are saving lives, because as you are aware, Mogadishu was a violent city for the last 20 years. So the area that maybe was safe today, it will not be safe tomorrow. So, for example, we have one program that awareness civilians what area needs to be avoided because there was maybe fighting taking place and what area is safe to go. So we believe we're saving lives, and that's what motivates us and drives us.
What kind of feedback do you get from your listeners in Mogadishu and elsewhere in Somalia?
We have a huge audience of ordinary men and women, regardless of what town and city and ethnicity they come from. They appreciate the job we're doing for them. When you walk on the street, they shake your hand and thank you for what we do. The only enemy we have is the political players who are obviously trying to shut down the independent media house and try to oppress media organizations. But the feedback we are getting from the people, we sometimes conduct a program that people can call our studio, and it seems to me more than 90% of the calls we are getting indicate that people are very happy with the service we are providing them, and we receive a lot of appreciation and thanks.
What is the key reason why they tune into your station?
First thing is they know we're not supporting any parties. We are obviously independent. Each party, the bad things they do to the community, we broadcast it. The good things they do, we broadcast it. And sometimes we upset some people because we broadcasted and reported the fact, and they may not like it.
Do journalists understand that they are taking huge risks when they agree to work with you?
Yes, absolutely they do.
And why are they so determined to work for you?
I would say two main reasons. One is the journalists who are obviously sacrificing their lives by going on the field and reporting believe like we do that they are doing good things for the community. They are promoting peace, stability, human rights, and freedom of speech and information. Second thing is Shabelle Media Network is one of the established and biggest media organizations in Somalia. A lot of journalists who started their journalism career in Shabelle are today working big media organizations. So obviously they can see the future, and they can see they can develop and gain a lot of skills, experience that might lead a very established career for them.
Why are you such a lone voice in Somalia?
There was other organizations, but unfortunately, Al-Shabaab are recently looted and taken over for those independent radio stations, such as Horn Afrique. It was a very big media organization, but unfortunately, Al-Shabaab took over and looted all their equipment.
How do other journalists in Somalia operate? What are the kind of problems that they have to deal with?
If I give you an example, for the last 2 years, only Shabelle, 5 journalists were killed, including our directors. 7 journalists suffered severe injuries. 21 journalists were in prison. We've been taken off the air and shut down for more than 4 times. Almost 100 professional journalists that we were trained has been forced to flee the country. That explains the risks and the difficulties that the Somali journalists are operating.
Lastly, if you could just sum up for me what this award means for you and your team of journalists.
I cannot describe in word how much this award means to us. Reporters Without Borders recognizing our hard work and dedication and giving us the moral support. Obviously, this award is not only for Shabelle Media Network. This award is for all the Somali journalists facing risks every day. And obviously, this will drive us and motivate us to continue our struggle.
Ali Dahir of Radio Shabelle in Mogadishu, and the experiences of Somali journalists are all too familiar to their counterparts in Sudan, which saw an upsurge in intimidation of journalists as the country prepared for the recent independence referendum. Tajaldin Adam is a Sudanese reporter for Radio Dabanga, an IWPR partner station based in the Netherlands, which broadcasts to Darfur. Radio Dabanga. We spoke to Tajaldin in the run-up to the vote.
For journalists in Sudan, it has always been tricky to report on issues that even the government talked about in state-owned media outlets. So it's a difficult situation. The government would intimidate and stop every journalist who tried to seek independent kind of coverage. Now there have been a number of arrests, including staff from Radio Dabanga. There have been other incidents of journalists who have been arrested or jailed. And I think today's situation is even worse because all the world is now focused on the issue of the South and North implementation of peace agreement, the CPA. So in this respect, the international community, no one can pressure the government to halt its crackdown on media and journalists.
We asked Tajaldin why the Sudanese government was seeking to suppress freedom of speech and curtail the activities of journalists.
This is not unique to Sudan. It has to do to all countries where political atmosphere is dominated by one party like what we have in Sudan. So it is the political atmosphere, it is the holistic situation of Sudan that is conducive to this kind of censorship of media. All these type of undemocratic problems that we face in Sudan.
Tajaldin went on to explain how things had deteriorated and gave us an example. It concerned a Sudanese newspaper which supports one of the opposition parties, the PNC. The paper carried an interview with the party leader Hassan al-Turabi in which he made claims of close military and intelligence cooperation between the Sudanese government and Iran. The government's response, says Tajaldin, wasn't long in coming.
Immediately after the publication of that interview, we have had national security forces storming the newspaper's office, arresting journalists and sealing the offices. And later, these three journalists have been charged under the national security law. They have sentenced two of the journalists for 3-year jail terms and the one for 5 years. Journalists are very vulnerable people. They have no political parties to back them. They have no protection. And also the engagement of international communities in Sudan is more about tackling the most serious issues like the war in Darfur and the situation of the South. So the journalists in Sudan face a very grim situation.
And that, Tajaldin told us, includes the very real risk of being tortured for journalists who have the misfortune of being taken into detention. Recently, the government seems to have been cracking down especially hard on Darfuri journalists. Tajaldin again.
Basically, the government considers Darfur is at war with the government, and that maybe explain why it's targeting the Darfuris. Whereas in the South, in places such as Juba, because of the absence of government, press journalists continue to enjoy some level of freedom. But Darfur is an exception because of the policies of the government toward Darfur, I think. This is true for journalists, true for lawyers, true for activists, true for political figures. So it is the government versus Darfur.
That was Tajaldin Adam of Radio Dabanga. You're listening to Africa Media Matters from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Uganda's High Court has ruled that the media may not publish the names and photos of gay men and lesbian women. Homosexuality is illegal in Uganda, but last October, the tabloid Rolling Stone provoked a storm of protest after it disclosed the names, addresses, and pictures of scores of gay men and lesbians. Now, the magazine has been ordered to pay damages and court costs for the three activists who sued the magazine. Shortly before the court's ruling, Africa Media Matters asked Godfrey Odongo of Amnesty International in Uganda whether the Rolling Stone affair reflected a broader Ugandan media prejudice against homosexuals.
Yes, that is very much so. I mean, Amnesty International has had concern at frequent reports by sections of the Ugandan media, particularly tabloids, which go into targeting individuals. And that often leads to violence and harassment, and particular people named as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender have been ostracized by colleagues, neighbors, and families.
Why is the subject of homosexuality not treated in a more impartial way by the media?
The media's treatment of this subject is reflective of widespread homophobia in Uganda and, by extension, in Africa in general.
Why hasn't there been more regulation of press coverage where so much of it has been tantamount to incitement?
It is the government allowing impunity to reign supreme, especially where we are talking about a minority group that the government considers not popular, and so they're easy targets, and so the media can get away with this. The example here is that with the October edition of the Rolling Stone, the new tablet coming out, the Media Council, which is one of the regulatory bodies under statutory law in Uganda, was approached with this matter. The Media Council proceeded not to look at the content. What it went for was the technical issues of whether the new publication had complied with licensing and registration requirements, ducking its responsibility in a way.
What needs to change for a more impartial approach to homosexuality and related issues?
The first thing is introspection. The media ought to take responsibility and then give more objectivity. The second issue is, what is the role of the government? Amnesty International is of the view that governments are the primary duty bearers to ensure human rights violations are dealt with and impunity is dealt with.
Are human rights activists alone in calling for a more progressive approach to the coverage of homosexuality and unrelated issues?
Far from it. It is important to recall that with the publication in September 2009 of the Anti-Homosexuality Bill, there was a strong constituency of local civil society organizations coming together under the banner of the Coalition on Constitutional Law and Other Rights. Now, from the point of view of those dealing with healthcare, there was that the enactment of the bill would significantly limit the power and the authority of public health professionals to deal with people with regard, for example, to issues of HIV/AIDS prevention. The mainstream religious sector was pretty much in support of the bill. But having said that, there's a significant minority within the religious sector that is opposed to this bill and has called for a more objective analysis.
Have there been any media in Uganda that have actually supported homosexuals in opposing the legislation?
In a way, credit must be given to the mainstream print and electronic media for having allowed for debate on both sides of the issue. The coalition of organizations opposing the bill has put up statements from time to time, and this has received media space. So certain sections of the mainstream media have done a commendable job in giving space or objectivity for both sides of the debate. But that is not enough. A lot more needs to be done.
That was Godfrey Odongo of Amnesty International in Uganda. 16 years after the end of apartheid, the South African media lacks diversity, according to the Johannesburg government. The print media continues to be English-dominated, despite the fact that the country has 11 official languages. But now, South Africa's largest circulation weekly paper, the Sunday Times, has launched an edition in Zulu, the first national paper to do so. Chris Swepu, acting chief executive of the Pan-South African Language Board, established by Parliament to promote multilingualism, describes the significance of the launch.
Well, it's important because one way of encouraging the development of indigenous languages is to ensure they are used for the print media. So to that extent, we are very excited that the Sunday Times have taken this route. We hope that there are plans to bring newspapers in other indigenous languages as well.
Why aren't there more indigenous language publications in South Africa?
The issue of profit and market availability always becomes a stumbling block in arguments. For instance, when one newspaper called Isolezwe published in Sizulu was launched, some in the media industry argued that there is no market for the newspapers. And as we speak today, it is one of the leading newspapers in our country in terms of sales. So there is a market. Only 8% of the people of this country are English mother tongue speakers. Now, really, one doesn't understand why there is no investment in these languages. There is a market.
So what can be done to try and encourage indigenous language publications?
We need to create a situation where there is value in speaking, writing, and using these indigenous languages. At the moment, we are encouraging members of parliament to use these languages, because you see, the mentality is that when the political and business leadership of the country is using only English, the masses of our country are also beginning to think that in order to make it to the ladder of the elite, you've got to speak English. So that is why we need to convert the leadership first. But once our people see value in that, then I think the situation would improve in our country. One also thinks that the more government itself communicates in indigenous languages and creates value around them, the more business people we will get who are interested in doing the same. So it's a parallel process of encouragement that we seek to do.
That was Chris Swepu talking to us from South Africa. Well, that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll listen again to the next edition of Africa Media Matters. This program was brought to you by the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and made possible by the generous support of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. To subscribe and for our terms of use, please go to iwpr.net/Africa Media Matters, or you could subscribe through iTunes. IWPR, giving voice, driving change.